Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. There have been very few years since World War II that someone named Carnahan is not holding public office in the state of Missouri. This will be one of them. Missouri Secretary of State Robin Carnahan has left office after two terms. She declined to seek re-election in 2012. Her brother Russ has left Congress after four terms, representing the 3rd Congressional District. Redistricting led him to challenge fellow Congressman Lacey Clay in the 1st District last year. The challenge was unsuccessful. What next? Is this the end of a political dynasty that has included their grandfather, father, mother, and themselves? We'll ask them as Robin and Russ Carnahan join me in studio. Thank you both so much for being with us. Nice to see you.
Good to be with you. Happy New Year.
Same to you guys. This must be an interesting time, Robin, an opportunity to sleep in all of a sudden.
Well, I haven't been doing much of that. Somebody asked me, what are you doing now? And I said, I'm cleaning the house after having in-laws visit for 3 weeks. So it's been fun, and I'm trying to get life back to normal.
Well, and we'll talk a little bit about what the new normal may be for you. But, Congressman, back to you. You're going back to Washington tomorrow, as I understand it. What's going on?
Well, I have some things that I'm working on out there, both on the public sector side and on the private sector side, that I've been having some conversations with people about. And so that's a work in progress, but I'll keep people posted as that progresses forward.
You are looking for work.
I have several options that I'm working on, and we'll get those nailed down soon.
Okay, we're not going to talk about those. I gather, at this particular point, those options.
I will be able to do that sooner than later, but they're in progress right now.
But we're always looking for a scoop on this program. So if you want to break any news here, and Robin, what about you? I mean, when the house is clean, what then?
Well, stay tuned. I haven't made any decisions about that yet either. But now that as of noon yesterday, I was officially finished with my job as Secretary of State. So I'll begin to focus more seriously on what comes next.
Do you have any sense of the kinds of things that you might like to do?
Well, I want to continue to serve in some way and put together my experience both in government and the private sector over the last 25 years. You know, as Secretary of State, it's like running a service delivery business. We've got tens of thousands of customers and 250 employees and a $50 million annual budget. So I like to run things, so hopefully I can get back to that.
Well, you're pretty much a farmer these days from what I've been reading.
Well, I do still manage the family cattle farm down in Rolla, and we survived the drought this summer and hoping the winter isn't too hard and too long so that we can get by with the hay that we have. But that's the same problem that all the farmers around the Midwest are facing.
That's a tough business, too. I mean, politics can be tough, but farming has got to be among the toughest.
You know, I never knew how much farming was like gambling. You know, farmers are gamblers. They have to gamble on things, the weather and commodity prices and lots of things, and they work awful hard getting there. So I have nothing but respect for people who feed us every day.
Yeah. Congressman, I know you must be reading the newspapers, and there must be kind of a bittersweet aspect to what your thoughts might be as you hear what's going on in the place that you used to reside professionally for the last 8 years. But what are your thoughts as you see what appears to be more of the same?
Yeah, I wouldn't say bittersweet. The Congress is essential to this country, how we're represented there. It's just, and I think these things go in cycles. We are digging our way out of a cycle where Congress has been very divided, very dysfunctional, and it's really not the best for the country until that really works its way out. And I think in the long term, it may take a few more elections. But also, I'm still kind of stubbornly optimistic. I think that's the way I look at it. But it's going to take a lot more engagement. And I think citizens are going to have to continue to keep their eye on Congress, their eye on their representatives, to be sure they're doing the right thing and not just putting up these artificial, ridiculous barriers to things that seem so common sense to people looking at it from the outside.
You know, the needle hasn't moved, although the most recent Congress is brand new. The needle hasn't moved very far with regard to the public's approach to this Congress and the polls, what they show about public attitudes toward this Congress. I would, I think, feel relieved if I were leaving something that was thought of in such low regard by the public at large.
Well, but, you know, still I approached it from a perspective that it was my job to really engage the people here in St. Louis, the people here in Missouri, to really be a voice and an advocate for them, even during these tough times, even when Congress was divided. That's the way it's supposed to work. And I'm still idealistic enough to think that we need to continue to look at it in that way.
Robin, as you look, you watch from afar, from the middle of the country. What are your thoughts about what you see going on in Washington? You've been in politics for a while.
Well, I too think this is a cycle that we're going through, but we're going to have to change some things to get out of the cycle. I think campaign finance reform is a big part of that, and I think the way redistricting is done is also a big part of that. And so until we fix those things, it's going to be hard for moderates and folks in the center to have the voice that we think and most common sense people think ought to have in government. You know, we were raised in a family that thought, if you get into government, you do it because you want to actually get things done. If you don't want to get things done or you don't believe in government, you ought to go do something else. But you don't want people who are running the government who don't believe that it has a function. You know, Dad used to always say he didn't want to be governor to warm a chair. He wanted to be there to get things done. And I've tried in my time in public service to actually be pragmatic and just get things done for people. And I think that's what people expect out of Washington. But the way the system's set up right now, politics trumps pragmatism almost every time. And this upcoming debate over the debt ceiling is going to be a great example of whether we can get past that.
Do you see any wiggle room at all with regard to the issues that you raise being so important, campaign finance and redistricting? I mean, again, from the outside looking in, I don't see much.
Look, I think that only happens at the state level. When you have a group of folks in Washington or any place where they've succeeded under a system, chances are they're going to want to keep the system because there's not a big incentive to change. But a lot of states are experimenting with different ways to do redistricting and different ways to do campaign finance. And so I think, as Russ said, it's going to be about people being vigilant and holding their elected officials accountable and really, you know, deciding what kind of government they want to have. Do they want to have just the highest bidder be in control, or do they want to be in control? And in the end, that's what this all boils down to, is how engaged citizens are prepared to be in running the government.
Congressman, do you see any of that wiggle room that I mentioned? Or
I think there is, and I would point out one observation to this election. Going into it, I really worried about a number of close elections from the presidential race on down, that the grotesque amounts of outside money that were spent along with some pretty serious voter suppression efforts would really make a difference in a lot of races. I think one thing we can conclude from the races this year is there's a limit to the effectiveness of massive amounts of money, because we really saw a pretty round failure of some of the super PAC spending around the country. And so I think clearly voters discounted and filtered that substantially. But it also still makes the point. There's still far too much money in politics. We need to do reform at the federal level in terms of super PACs to have reporting and disclosure more than is there now. But I think, as Robin said, a lot of that needs to be driven at the state level. And Missouri is like the Wild West. We have no campaign spending limits here. You have reporting only.
And the redistricting issue, of course, you know firsthand what kind of problems that can cause incumbents or any candidates.
Well, it's really bigger than any individual candidate or race, because you look at this current Congress, it's really because lines have been drawn to favor strong Democratic districts and strong Republican districts. You've really hollowed out that political center that is vital to really press a lot of things through. And you've also seen the situation in Republican primaries, where many of the so-called moderate traditional Republicans are being challenged from their far right. Mm-hmm. So it's really made the Congress even more, a larger gulf between the two parties at a time when we need them to work together even more.
I've forgotten what the exact number is, but it's well over a million votes that were cast for Democrats in congressional races across the country than Republicans, and yet they did so poorly this time around.
In the Missouri example, we're famous for being a state that's fairly split down the middle politically, yet you look at the congressional districts we have in Missouri. Out of eight districts, we have six pretty strong Republican districts and only two strong Democratic districts. And that doesn't really very adequately reflect the composition of the state.
In retrospect, do you wish maybe that you had run in the second?
No, I don't have any second thoughts about my decision. I really made it clear very early I was going to run for re-election no matter what the lines turned out to be, and that I was going to really challenge the existing law to be sure that was done, even up to the state Supreme Court. So I feel like I did what I pledged to do, and also I think it was important to have the race and have it be run the way it was, even in a Democratic primary. It was clearly spirited, and I think that's not a bad thing for our party.
Robin, would that have been your advice to him, to run or not run on the second?
Oh, well, I stay out of what he wants to do. But I will say, in terms of just redistricting in general and across the country, because districts and seats are so safe, the polarization has become even stronger. And you see it in Congress where when you don't have middle ground, there's no reason to compromise. And in the end, that doesn't serve the country well, because I think most people in the country just want government to do what it's supposed to do and get out of the things it's not supposed to do. But don't be dysfunctional, and don't have your inability to get anything done drag down the economy as we're having right now.
That's Robin Carnahan, former Secretary of State here in the state of Missouri. Also joining me in studio is Russ Carnahan, former congressman from the 3rd District in our state of Missouri. We'll be back to continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Robin and Russ Carnahan. We're talking about their days in political office and their days ahead. I guess the two of you are still trying to figure out exactly what those days ahead are going to include, but we shall soon find out, I hope. You know, Robin, I was saying off the air, and you raised an interesting point about the futility that so many people feel these days. We can talk about citizen involvement, but there is a certain wave out there, people feeling no matter what I do, no matter what I say, no matter what I think, nothing's going to change. These people are in control through redistricting, through whatever. How can we change it?
Well, you know, in Missouri and about 23 or 24 other states, there's a process for there to be direct public votes on issues. You know, we see those long questions on the ballots every couple of years. But a lot of the major changes that have happened in our state have happened through those initiative petitions. We started a Missouri Department of Conservation years and years ago after clear cutting of trees in our state through an initiative process. We had the first campaign finance limits were through the initiative process. Sales taxes have come through that process. So we have lots of things that have happened because citizens have said, you know what, the guys who are representing us in Jefferson City are not responding to things we care about, and we're going to vote on this directly. So I suspect we're going to see more of that going forward. And that's a process that in our state needs some reform because it's, it's a very cumbersome process that a lot of money can influence as well. So we got to get that right, and some other states have done a little better.
Did you notice during your 8 years as Secretary of State that there was an increase in the number of these petitions?
Oh, goodness, yes. I think my first year we had 6 or 8 submitted for review. And this last year, I think the number was 180. The funny thing is, still only 3 or 4 ever make it to the ballot. So it's become a game that lots of lawyers and lots of interest groups play to try to get language that they like. And that's the part that needs reform. But the notion that citizens ought to be able to vote on things that affect their lives, I think, is really important.
Well, this is another big money issue, too, because there are people with big bankrolls that are getting behind a number of these petitions.
That's right, and we'll see more of those, I'm sure, in the years ahead. But in the end, it is important for citizens to be able to vote on these things, and I think in Missouri we're lucky to get a chance to do that.
You know, you've had kind of a target on your back as Secretary of State when it comes to these petitions, because rarely does one surface that the language is not questioned. Talk to us a little bit about that, this process, and why there is so much sound and fury over the wording.
You know, it's really fascinating. The litigation over the ballot title, it's called, that 50 words or 100 words with a question mark at the end, that has exponentially increased about 800% since I've been in office. And typically, the secretary gets sued by both sides. So someone writes this and wants it talked about in a certain way and the opponents want it talked about in a different way. I always described it as being like somebody who was putting the squib on the back of the book, the blurb, you know. Mm-hmm. You're not changing anything in the book. You're not changing the content. You just have a description of it. And so my job was always to try to write that in a way that was fair, not necessarily what the advocates wanted, not necessarily what the opponents wanted, but in a way that Missourians actually knew what they were voting on.
Who actually does the writing?
Well, it's a process that starts with the general counsel's office when I was there, and then it's reviewed by the attorney general. And so it's a long process with lots of people taking a look.
Well, some of the criticism that comes out during these debates that I've just mentioned is the notion that Robin Carnahan is a Democratic Secretary of State, and therefore she has a political motive in the way this thing is worded. I gather from what you're telling me that this is impossible.
Well, look, Ed, anytime you're in public office, people are going to criticize you if they don't agree. So it just kind of comes with the territory. To me, my job was to make sure Missourians knew what they were voting on, that there was clarity about that, no matter whether the opponents liked it or didn't like it. We always knew we were going to get sued on everything, and so we just went ahead and tried to do the best we could. And I think our record was great on doing that.
Well, I want to throw Robin a compliment here, because one of the things I'm really proud of that she did is really playing those issues very straight up in, you know, in the through the official process. And I think it was a real level of confidence and competence that I think she did a great job.
As a former congressman, how do you look at the citizen involvement issue as Robin has just described it? And is it realistic to think that we out here watching what goes on at all political levels can really do something about it?
I absolutely believe that. And as a representative in the State House and in Washington, I always thought it was part of my job to really push that two-way dialogue and conversation, whether it was traditional town hall meetings or roundtables with experts here in St. Louis, telephone town halls, you name it, visiting experts and institutions here in the St. Louis area. It helps you be a better representative, but it also helps constituents understand and find ways where they can make a difference and weigh in on things that are important to them. So I think it's just vital to our process to really get to that more perfect union, that more perfect place for our democracy, which always is a work in progress. But it almost always works better when you have that involvement.
Have you found out in recent years, we saw the number of initiative petitions going up, have you found out at your town hall meetings and your gatherings with the public that attendance has gone up or down over the last couple of years?
They really vary, depending on the time, the circumstances, the issue. Some of the most notorious town halls were, of course, during the great debate over health care. Some that turned into, riot-like activities. But even when some of my staff were recommending that I not have them, I said, I'm going to continue to do these, even if they're difficult, even if they're contentious, because I think it's my job, number one. But also, if I don't, then the people that just want to stir up trouble win. I think it varies depending on the issue, but it's whether you get 10 people at a town hall or 300, I think it's important that you give people that opportunity to be a part of the process.
Yeah. What do you look for on the health care front in the months ahead? It's still under attack from many quarters.
It's still, but the ways where the opponents can make any substantial dents in it keep diminishing. It's been vital for our country. I think people have forgotten where we started in this debate. A very broken healthcare system with cost escalating dramatically, not sustainable. And you look at what's been done just in a short period of time, some of the most well-known parts of it, doing away with discrimination based on pre-existing conditions, having discounts for employers and employees to afford credit, preventative care. You can go down the list, things that are very popular. People are going to use those services, and it's going to make a difference in our healthcare system. So it's much needed. I'll never forget the day the Senate passed the final version. I had a room full of mothers and their young kids, all that had pre-existing conditions. And there was not a dry eye in the room. But it is going to make a difference in a lot of lives.
Robin, it looks, though, as if many of the battlefronts are going to be in individual states as they look at Medicaid, for instance, and things of that nature, the exchanges and what have you. States are going to play a big role. Should they be?
That's the American way. Mm-hmm. You know, we have this federal system where we let states experiment and do things. I think that, in the end, that's a good thing. It's hard getting places because it means there's a lot of confusion. And nowadays, with the way people get their information, there's more confusion, right? It used to be that news was more local, and now people tend to get news in a national way. And so when they hear about differences from one state to the next, there's more confusion about it. So that's going to take some sorting out. But in the end, I think these laboratories of democracy out in the states are very healthy, and I think in the healthcare debate, they will be healthy as well. You're going to see some states that opt out and say, no, we don't want to have any part of it. And guess what? These other states are going to have citizens who have lots better and cheaper health care. And in the end, I think the other states will come around.
I saw something in the paper this morning indicating that Jan Brewer, the governor of right. Arizona, seems to be shifting a little bit. And she was a stalwart anti-ACA for so many months.
She and a number of other Republican governors in the West have said, look, we're having to pay into this system. Of course, we ought to get some of our money back out of it. And yeah. Quite frankly, I hope that's the decision that the legislature here in Missouri comes to as well.
Yeah. Another issue that you would certainly be concerned with that many states are wrestling with now is this whole voter ID situation. It's come up in Missouri. Where do you see that going? And as part of the political process, how do you view it?
Look, we fought that battle from my first years in office. Every year. And my view is this. I'm not against voters having to show some form of identification to vote. It's only logical. You need to identify yourself. And in Missouri, that is required already. What I don't like is the idea that there is only one type of ID that the state issues to people that is what you have to vote, when not all citizens have that. You know, I've observed elections in a lot of countries around the world. It's been one of the things I've enjoyed doing over the years. And the United States has a unique system in the whole world in that we don't have any kind of identification of us as citizens. Mm-hmm. That's what this all comes down to. Mm-hmm. So you have the same people who don't want to have national ID cards demanding that there be an ID card that's issued by the state in order to vote. And so it's a very contradictory type of exercise that we're going through here. So my view is, as long as there are people who don't have these IDs, and in Missouri there are about 240,000 legitimate voters who don't have a state-issued driver's or non-driver's license, 240,000, that's a lot of people. And they should not lose their right to vote because people are dreaming up that there's some kind of voter identity fraud. You know, the other part about this that's frustrating is that there are a lot of things we can do to improve our election system and to prevent fraud in the system. But people impersonating somebody else in the voting booth is not one of the problems. There are lots of problems about voter registration, and we ought to try to streamline that. I think moving that online and making it more automatic, tying it to our driver's license list, which would get you about 95% of the people covered, is a very logical and smart thing to do. A lot of other states are doing it. I tried to get that done here in Missouri, but it always turned into this goofy debate about requiring IDs in order to vote. And I wasn't willing to risk disenfranchising 240,000 Missourians over it.
Congressman, that is an interesting part of this whole discussion, the fact that there is so little evidence throughout the country of actual voter fraud while this clamor is going on for voter ID.
Yeah, you're more likely to be struck by lightning, I think, than, you know, to see some kind of real voter fraud. And, you know, those 240,000 people that Robin mentioned, those tend to be seniors, students, disabled, military,
the poor.
And so that's we really need to be thinking about ways, and we can do this with technology, and with just common sense measures, that make it easier for people to vote. You don't increase the risk of voter fraud, and because most of this stuff is ginned up and made up and not really legitimate.
You know, using the internet, for instance, as has been suggested, a couple of things come to mind with regard to that. Number one is not everybody has a computer, and there are not a lot of those people that you mentioned that don't, and if they even have exposure to it, they are afraid to use them. And then there are the glitches, the things that happen with computers. We even see it with the voting machines. People, the last time around, people were pushing one button and the tally was being recorded someplace else. I'll start with you, Congressman. Do you fear that these things can be tampered with? They can be ineffective as well as effective at times.
I am concerned about that. Technology is a two-edged sword in that regard because obviously it can create great efficiencies, but we've also heard a number of stories of where people have tampered or could tamper with those kind of systems. And Robin is by far the expert on this because she's dug into that in great detail.
Well, look, when it comes to voting, it's about voter confidence. That's the fundamental thing. So no matter what system you come up with or what technology you use, if it doesn't have the confidence of voters and increased confidence that the result of the election reflects the will of the governed, that it doesn't work. So fundamentally, you have to have accuracy, security, privacy, all of these fundamental things that we expect out of our voting system. So there are those that are experimenting with this. There are some countries, by the way, that have access to online and even mobile voting. Estonia is way ahead of the rest of the world in this. Are we ever going to get there? Maybe someday. I'm not sure it'll be in my lifetime, but it probably will. Because technology is becoming a lot more ubiquitous in people's lives. Now, the important thing is that it not disenfranchise anybody. And so we have to do it in ways that are smart. There are parts of this, and when it comes to election reform, that can be done right now that's helpful to folks. And I think voter registration is one of the biggest deals in that, and that we ought to try to automate that process. And I asked a group the other day if they'd raise their hand, how many people after they'd moved had called their prior voting, you know, official and told them that they'd moved to take them off the voter list. You know, that's what you're supposed to do. Well, it just doesn't happen. People die. People move. They don't call and update the people that they left. They maybe get on the new roll. We have ways with technology to automate all that stuff now so you don't have to re-register all the time. And if we could just get past this registration issue, it would be a huge efficiency across the board.
Why do so few Americans vote? Well, you talk about Estonia and places like that. I'm sure that they have a much higher percentage voter turnout than we do.
I think, look, there are a couple of things. Part of it's this registration issue that creates a barrier. So they don't know if they're registered. They don't want to waste their time. They don't know where to go. So part of it's a process thing we can fix. But the other part is understanding the issues and thinking their voice matters. And if people either think it's not going to be a fair vote, so why bother and waste my time, or they're all the same and they're all a bunch of dirt bags and it doesn't matter who I vote for, then they're probably not going to waste their time. So part of it's a process thing that we can get right in government, and the other is about the words that come out of the mouths of elected officials and candidates about why it does matter for people to participate.
I would add to that just the whole role of education. You know, hardly anything's worse than, you know, think about going into a voting booth and seeing a list of names that you don't know, you don't know anything about, or a ballot issue that you're not sure whether you vote yes or no, what's going to help you. It's that sort of educational component is so vital, and that's why, again, I think elected officials, candidates, community organizations, that kind of outreach and education makes a huge difference to break down some of those barriers where people just don't feel like they understand the issues well enough to make informed decisions. So that's got to be a piece of it.
And we can also go back to an earlier part of our conversation, and that is people feel like, what the heck? My vote's not going to make any difference anyway, right?
And right. And in the end, I always tell people that it does. You know, we see what's happening in other parts of the world that have thrown off the yoke of dictatorships or autocratic governments. And And you wonder sort of what drives people to do that. And it really is about a sense of dignity and respect, that they want that and are demanding that from their government. And it just strikes me that we need to have that conversation again in the United States, that we as Americans deserve respect and dignity from those who govern us. And when we see people playing games and not doing their jobs and putting partisanship ahead of the people, that's not treating them with dignity and respect. And so I see that this is sort of fomenting out there all of the time. And look, throughout our history, we've seen it go up and down. And so I think we're living in very interesting times, and that people, particularly with technology, are going to be able to have their voices heard even more. I mean, you've seen it in some of these debates in Washington where you can get people to do online petitions and various things that get folks' attention that they never were able to do before. That's pretty exciting.
The Chinese do have an expression, we live in interesting times.
Right.
And they've been saying it for a long time. Have to take another break now. My guests in studio are Robin Carnahan, former Secretary of State here in Missouri, and Russ Carnahan, former Congressman from the 3rd Missouri Congressional District. Back to continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our conversation with Robin and Russ Carnahan. I'd like to talk a little bit to you guys about growing up and in the family environment in which you grew up, which caused you to follow in the footsteps of other members of your family and go into public service. Congressman, I'll start with you. Give me some sense of what it was like and how you evolved to get into this world of politics and service.
Yeah, I guess two quick stories. My first memory of politics, I was 8. And I remember my mom had organized this campaign for my dad, who was running for the state legislature. And she organized something called the Caravan for Carnahan. And we ran around to different small towns, had a flatbed truck with loudspeakers and an upright piano. And they sang songs and gave, you know, did political speeches. And then we leafleted the town.
He's got the whole world in his hands. That's one of the songs, right?
And we had these red straw cowboy hats with stickers on the front. And, you know, we would hand out literature and hop in the cars and go to the next town. And it was just, it was fun. And seeing people, talking to people. And then years later, after I graduated from college at Mizzou, I was dad's driver for that first statewide campaign in 1980, and getting to travel with him as a young man, to see him interact with people, see his passion for people and to make a difference. I think that was always inspiring to me. And as a family, we always worked together in his campaigns. And I think that I didn't have my mindset at that early age to really say I was going to run for office. But when opportunities presented themselves, it worked out, and it's been a great way to really give back and be a part of public service.
And of course, you had a great role model, and that always helps to have
had a just phenomenal role model.
Was there ever a time when he sat down with you and said, "Russ, this is what I think about things. This is what I think you might be thinking about, or should be thinking about"?
I don't remember ever having a conversation like that.
How about you, Rob?
You know, Russ was talking about that early campaign, and I remember that too. I was, you know, probably 5 years old at the time, and I loved being able to go up and talk to strangers and tell them how great my dad was and wear that red cowboy hat. I still have one of those. And ride in the back of a convertible. That's the other thing I have a very vivid memory about. So that big campaign.
The red convertible.
Yes. Yeah, with 3 seats in it. Remember that? Mm-hmm. It wasn't, I don't know what kind it was, but it didn't have just 2. Anyway, so campaigns were fun, and they brought the family together, and it was a very sort of, you know, time when a lot of times in families, everybody goes off and does their own thing. And in our family, when campaigns came about, everyone came from wherever they were and came back and worked on this joint cause. And so that always made it nice. But Dad was not one to sit down and lecture us or tell us what we ought to do. He very much lived by example. And that's something I always really appreciated.
Did he tell you, if not what to do, but how to do whatever you undertook?
He always admonished us to do the best we could at whatever we were doing. and to spend time on things we cared about. I remember when I, after 1992, he won the governor's race and Bill Clinton became president, and I'd never really voted for anybody who'd won anything before, so it was sort of an exciting time, and I went off to Washington and worked in the Clinton administration, and I remember being at a place, and I was so frustrated and thought, this government, this big bureaucracy is just horrible, and I was just kind of mad about the whole thing for 6 months and thought Ross Perot was kind of right. The whole thing should just be blown up and started over again, and wondered how this government could ever work. And I remember having this conversation with Dad, and he said, you know, a lot of times in life, it's kind of like you're in a big ship. You're kind of along for the ride, and other people are making the decisions about the direction and where you go. And every now and then, you get to steer. And when you get to steer, make it count. And I thought, you know what? This is about picking things that matter and focusing all your energy on that. And I have done that in my days in public service, and it really makes a difference. You don't have to fix everything. Just fix a few. And it really will make a difference for the long term and the direction that you want things to go.
You know, given what you've just said and the way that you've said it, I'm getting the impression that you are not through. That you really feel if things are going to happen and things have to change, that you're going to have to be a part of that.
Well, we'll see. Opportunities come up in life, but I understand life is short, and you want it, and I'm impatient to make a difference wherever I can. And It was a good example to be able to see Dad go in and out of public life. He thought his time in the private sector was really valuable and made him a better governor. And so I think it's important that people have experiences that give them a better perspective. And I hope to get that too.
You know, I hate to raise this subject and revive this memory, but his untimely death, Congressman, I wonder if that had a motivating factor. Did it cause you perhaps, and the same a question to you, Robin, when that happened and he was taken from you guys, did you feel more inclined to, you were already a member of the Missouri legislature at that time, more inclined to serve?
Well, no, actually, I had just won a Democratic primary in August of 2000, which was tantamount to winning the election,
yeah,
but
okay.
I was still campaigning for the November ballot in 2000 when Dad was killed. So we had, you know, turned our attention to helping out in his race. So I had already started on that path, but you know, I think he had already instilled in us, I think, the importance of making a difference in giving back, no matter what you do. And being in elected office is just one way to do that. And certainly I had a great opportunity when there was an opening in a state house seat to do that here. It's not something I had particularly set out to do. And not long after I had started in the state house, Dick Gephardt made the surprise announcement he was going to retire. And so, again, I had these two openings back to back. And so I had an opportunity to serve. I'm very glad I did. I had some wonderful inspiration to do that, some wonderful experience to bring with me to do that. But I feel like it was an important time to be involved and that I was able to make a contribution. So it was a great experience for me, and just to work with so many people in this community was a great part of my career.
And Robin, you famously said upon your father's death that the fire must not go out, or words to that effect. So I'm gathering from words like that that was a motivating factor for you, perhaps.
Well, sure. I think anytime somebody's life is touched in the way ours was, and you lose a loved one, it sort of reminds you about what's important. It reminds you that life is short and your time to make a difference is short and fleeting, and that you need to get on with it. And so I think that was a motivating factor for me, and it's a lesson I've kept with me. Don't waste time. Do things that are important and make a difference.
You know, we can talk about your dad, and it's a pleasure doing so.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have to talk about Mom, because this led to one of the most famous episodes in Missouri political history when your mother wound up in the Senate. Talk a little bit about that time and what you were thinking as this was happening and Mom was headed for Washington.
Well, you know, I'm just so proud of Mom stepping up and serving in that way. It's such a difficult time. It was, when I think back about what she was going through, it was actually inhumane for her in so many ways, because she was running for re-election almost immediately upon getting there and trying to figure out about this new job. But she did a terrific job. And it just warms my heart even to this day when we're out someplace and people will stop her in the airport or stop her in the grocery store and thank her for her service. And she was a real role model for people about how to deal with adversity and how even when life doesn't turn out the way you hope that it will or you plan, that it really is about how you deal with that and how resilient you are that is the test of your character. And I think people appreciated that.
Did you think it was a good idea at the time?
I did.
Yeah.
And I still think it was a good idea.
How about you, Congressman?
Yeah, it was, again, it was in so many ways bizarre, strange, difficult. But it made sense at the time. And I think at a point when she was really had to think deep in herself about doing that, I think it clicked with her that it made sense, and she felt like it was the right thing to do to carry on what Dad had started. So I'm very proud of her, and I think she did the right thing.
What qualities did she bring to that job? Do you think that people might not fully understand or appreciate?
Well, she's smart, she's tough, and a quick study of just about anything. But I remember shortly after she started, she made a comment about that many people have made a career out of underestimating my father, and they shouldn't make that mistake with her. So she brought a lot of substance and passion and heart to the position, and it really was a way to respect the unprecedented thing that the voters did in that November of 2000 election.
Do you think, Robin, that she was accorded the total respect that any senator should have given the circumstances of her assuming that position?
You know, that would be a better question for you to ask her. Mm-hmm. From my observation, it seemed split, and there were some, certainly the Democratic caucus very much appreciated Mom and her service. There were members of the Republican caucus who did as well. And she became very friendly with them. And there were others that weren't. So it was really split. But I will say, just going back to that time, you know, I always thought it would have been a very interesting thing to be observing from the outside and if you weren't sort of involved in it, right? It would have been really, really fascinating. But it just goes to show you that elections are not about just one person. And when you're running for office, you figure that out pretty quickly, that it really is about what you can do for people and the values that you share and the commitments that you have and the hopes that you have for your future and the future of your country. And that's what was so important, to have Mom be there and go forward and take those hopes forward. And that's a good reminder for not just candidates, but for voters as well.
Well, around this part of the story, I certainly want to not ignore the fact that there were other losses in that tragic plane crash. Your brother, Randy, lost his life, as does Chris Sifford, whom I happen to know as a press secretary. So a very, very sad occasion. Mom left the Senate, and suddenly she became Irma Bombeck. She's been on this program a couple of times.
She's got another book on the way.
Does she really?
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait for it.
But, she's a great writer and communicator.
Yeah. What do you think about that part of her life? I mean, you talk about reinventing yourself.
Well, you know what? That's not quite right. Mom has always been the better writer and communicator in the family. She wrote a lot of Dad's speeches over the years. And so she was always the better speech giver and writer. And so that she sort of, you know, became an author wasn't surprising to me at all. And she's really good.
Well, when she was here last time, I used Irma Bombeck because that's what she used. She basically said that that's what she was modeling herself after. Congressman, your thoughts about this new stage in your mother's life?
You know, she really has flourished and really written with a lot of passion, and she's always sharing, you know what, I've got this idea for this next new book, and she just is very excited about it and just loves doing it. She has a fantastic talent for it. And
it's also really funny. People will read her books and they'll say, "I didn't know your mother was so funny." And I think that's funny because I always did know my mom was really funny.
Is the new book fiction, nonfiction? Is it more of what
she's she got a novel in the works? Have you read so far in the novel?
I only read a few pages.
Yeah.
But I'm waiting to see more.
Every time I see her, I'm like, "Where are you? Where are the characters now?" So we'll see what happens.
You have a brother, Tom, also. Mm-hmm. He's in the wind power business. Is that correct? Wind energy business, I guess. Is that correct?
Yes, he was, and he's sold out his interest in that.
Oh, he did.
But is still involved with, all I know, the National Wind Energy Association.
Where is all of that going, do you think? We have a couple of minutes left, and this is another issue that is an important one for all of us. Also political, but this whole energy thing and where we're going. Your thoughts on this, Congressman?
Yeah, it's just we've struggled, I think, as a country for a long time with being too dependent on fossil fuels, too dependent on importing from overseas. And just as a country, we really are at a point where it's not only smart but necessary for us to diversify more but also take advantage of new technologies. I mean, there's been dramatic advances in renewables, in solar, and advances in how we build our office buildings and our homes. I was involved in that a lot in the Congress with this high-performance building caucus. But it's a tremendous opportunity for our economy, for jobs, to really take advantage of these new technologies. And we have, you know, that good old-fashioned American innovation we need to take advantage of and then really spur that on, because that's going to be part of our economy, but also it's going to be essential for us in terms of how we utilize energy in this country.
Robin, where do you see it going?
Well, look, I think that there's no doubt that as a country we will not have economic security unless we have energy security. And we only have energy security if we get off dependence on foreign oil. And the only way we get that done is we diversify our energy supply. So that makes total sense in every way. So there's that economic piece of it. But then there's the sort of environmental piece of it, that we know it's having an impact on our planet. Farmers know that the climate is changing. And so it's important that we take responsibility for this going forward. And I think this is another one of those topics where the citizens are way ahead of the politicians. And in the end, I hope the politicians come around.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that. During the last political campaign, climate change, for instance, was hardly mentioned, if at all, during the entire campaign. So you have to wonder about the political side of this. Thoughts?
I always looked for some common ground during my time in Congress, and this green building sector is a good example. You see more and more companies, large and small, getting involved in this, not because they're a bunch of tree huggers, but just because of the cold, hard business bottom line. It's good business. And on top of that, most of the products, the heating and air conditioning systems, and you know, windows, things that go in our buildings, almost all are manufactured here. So you have the added benefit of promoting those other supplier companies. So it's a big deal that we take advantage of that innovation, and you're seeing that driven more and more by just smart business. And the government, because of its size, our national governments, state governments, local governments, they're making those kind of investments as well. So there is common ground there to make these kind of smart energy investments, and we have to push that. Even when we're in tough, divided political times, even those kind of things can get done.
A few seconds left. Robin, you want to put a final thought on that issue?
Well, I think this energy retrofit issue is in fact a very big deal, and it's just economically smart. People hate wasting things. All of us hate wasting things, and this is about not wasting things. And so when you make these improvements, it's good not just for the economy because of the investments, but it's good because you're not wasting.
Well, I'm going to leave it at that. I want to thank you both, Robin Carnahan and Russ Carnahan, for being with us. We tried to find out if you knew exactly what you're going to be doing next, but apparently we're not going to get that scoop this time. Perhaps you don't know yourself. But we appreciate your being here and wish you the very best in whatever direction you go in from here on out. Thank you, Robin. Thank you, Russ.
Great.
Thanks, Don.
Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the lack of a mental health safety net other than perhaps the justice system. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.